Support for the Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source in Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In a few minutes, we're going to be joined by historian Timothy Snyder to discuss his new book on freedom. But first, Texas Public Radio's education reporter Camille Phillips has been investigating the situation with special education in Texas, looking directly at how special ed teachers are being injured in the classroom, and the state isn't doing much to protect them. And Camille Phillips joins us now to tell us more. Hi, Camille. Welcome back to Source.
Hi, Dave. Thank you.
So tell me about what your investigation is about. I know that we had a fatal incident in a classroom. What happened?
Right. Well, my reporting is primarily based in San Antonio's largest school district at the moment, Northside ISD. In February of this year, there was an instructional assistant who worked in a special education class for students with intellectual disabilities. And he worked at Brandeis High School, and he was pushed and hit his head. Traumatic brain injuries, ended up dying 10 days later. His name is Alfred Jimenez Jr. Fred. Mr. Fred is what he was known as at school. And so that kind of started all of this. There was a teachers and his widow that I spoke with said that his death was kind of a wake-up call, that for a long time they just kind of accepted workplace injuries as part of the job, you know, bruises, concussions, bite marks. But they said his death made them realize that it's not something they could just accept, that this was a pattern that could lead to something as serious as death.
So they said basically being bitten, being hit, was just part of the job. Is that really just part of the job?
Well, it's primarily in self-contained classrooms with students that have the highest level of need. And it's not happening like every day, but the teachers I spoke with, they filed a grievance saying that it's a widespread pattern of student-caused injuries, most often in these self-contained classrooms for students who have intellectual disabilities.
I just wanted to draw, is that really what's expected? That teachers should be able to take a few bite marks or being a punch?
Not. Is that really
what the school district says? Okay, well, that's part of the job.
That's not what the school district says. You know, when I spoke to them, they said like they don't think it's common. But, you know, according to the grievance, it is a widespread pattern. And the teachers I spoke with and the photos I saw and the emails back and forth from administrators and these teachers are talking about like not having enough staff, and that's leading to the injuries primarily.
Yeah. So, okay, according to the school district, then how common is this, or how uncommon is this?
Well, when I spoke to the special education director, her name is Tracy Wernley. She's in charge of special education for Northside, and she said it's not common. It does happen, and does happen more often with a certain population of students. That's the way she explained.
Okay, but we're talking about kids who are they have special needs.
Right. And it's not it's not to say that the students are in any way at fault. Everyone I spoke with says that, you know, it's not the students' fault. A lot of they love their students, and the students, you know, just has something that's upset them, and they have a hard time expressing themselves. Perhaps they're nonverbal, and the staff just doesn't have the help, the adults in the room,
right,
to physically protect themselves and the other students. A lot of times they prioritize the other students, so they physically put themselves in between the student that's upset and the other students in the room.
Yeah, forgive me. I'm just really trying to dial in to what the school district finds to be acceptable or unacceptable. And if they're saying, well, this doesn't happen all that often, are they talking about the entirety of all the teachers in the classrooms? Or are they talking about teachers who are working within this specialized lane of dealing with kids in special ed?
Well, I mean, they're very circumspect in their language. I was only able to interview the district at all after agreeing not to speak about the grievance. They say it's pending litigation, and they wouldn't talk about that specifically at all.
But we do have a teacher who lost their life.
Yes. And you can hear my stories, you know, when I talked to Tracy Wernley, she said that she didn't believe there was anything missing that caused him to die. She called it a horrible accident, devastating, but she didn't believe that there was nothing, that there was anything the district could have done to prevent his death.
Are there standards of how many teachers, adults, not necessarily teachers, but just, you know, assistants, aides, who should be in the classroom? What is the expectation for the number of adults?
Well, I asked the district, and they don't have a set policy. It seems, according to like the union, it tends to be based on numbers, and one of their requests for relief in the grievance is to base it more on student needs. I talked to an expert. Her name's Elizabeth Bettini. She's a Boston University professor, and she says, when there's a classroom where there's students that have aggressive behavior, you need to have at least three adults in the room at all times, because, you know, you never want to restrain a student, but when they're hurting themselves or someone else, that's the one time that it is okay. And you just very carefully, safely restrain them. But you need two adults to do that, a third adult to document
that. When we had that fatal encounter.
Right.
Was that teacher alone in that classroom?
Well, it was actually in the gym.
In the gym?
And I don't know a lot about it. I've seen the workers' comp document from Margo Jimenez, which is the wife of the man who died. And it says that he was pushed. But I don't know how many people were in the gym at the time. But there were
witnesses. They have not disclosed that.
Right.
And so we're having a problem with school funding right now. Under Greg Abbott's administration, they have held back a lot of funding for school districts. We know that school districts are having to make cuts. Are we seeing that impacting the safety of teachers who are working in the classroom in special education?
Well, it's something you hear across the state, not just Northside, that they have difficulty paying their staff enough because they haven't had more salary. They haven't had more funding from the state since 2019. We've had a whole pandemic since then. Everything costs more. And it's hard to attract teachers when you can't pay them. Especially the main issue here, though, is instructional assistance. That's an entry-level job, but it's a really hard job.
You could get more salary working at a Chick-fil-A.
Exactly. That's what Cherie Kreisel, is one of the teachers I interviewed, pointed out, is that you can get more paid at Chick-fil-A. The starting pay for an instructional assistant is less than $16 an hour. It's a hard job.
All right. So is anything being done? Is there a recognition that there is a problem beyond your investigative reporting?
Oh yes. I mean, it's been long been hard to find enough special education teachers. There's a national shortage there, but it's especially acute in Texas. And it's even harder to keep instructional assistants. According to one research paper that the expert I talked to was part of, 43% of instructional assistants in special education quit their job each year. 43%. That's like almost half. And so it's just, how do you keep enough in the classroom if they're leaving at that rate?
So these teachers don't get hazard pay. As a matter of fact, just the opposite of it. They're being put in harm's way, dealing with kids with special needs who are biting, who are punching, have a fatal encounter. And the school district and across the state of Texas, there is very little transparency. They're not really just, you're investigating, you're talking to people, you're finding out stuff that no one else is finding out.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that was shocking for me to see. I had never heard of this, you know, students, special education teachers getting bite marks, concussions, and it's seems to be, according to them.
I know you're on the story. You've been working on it. You're going to continue on it. Camille Phillips, the Texas Public Radio education reporter. Thanks for doing all that. We got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about freedom. What is freedom? Why is freedom on the ballot? This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, I'm David Martin Davies. In this presidential election, there are two songs that have captured the vibe of the two candidates who want your vote. Vice President and Democratic nominee Kamala Harris uses the song from Beyoncé, Freedom. Former President Donald Trump makes use of the Lee Greenwood song, God Bless the USA, which extols that I'm proud to be an American where at least I know I'm free. Both these songs and their campaigns are presenting two very different views on freedom, a positive freedom and a negative freedom. We'll explain what that means in a moment. Donald Trump and today's Republican Party's vision of freedom is laid out in the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025, which would actively restrict freedom in America, particularly for women and non-Christians and people of color. In her DNC acceptance speech, Harris pointed and promised to defend the reproductive freedom of Americans and wanted and warned many fundamental freedoms are at stake, among them freedom from gun violence, the ability to love who you want to love, to live free from pollution that fuels the climate change, and finally, the freedom that unlocks all other freedoms, the freedom to vote. We're joined by Timothy Snyder. He's a historian. He's been called the leading interpreter of our dark times. His latest book is on freedom. And Tim, welcome to The Source.
Glad to be with you.
Are you seeing two different views of freedom being presented to voters in this election?
I'm seeing a very stark contrast, to be sure. The Trump people actually don't talk very much about freedom anymore, which is interesting. And when they do, they talk about it in a circular way. Like, you don't know you're free because you're an American. You never know you're free. Freedom is something that you've got to struggle for, you've got to look for, you've got to think about. It comes down to you individually. It can't be brought to you by a leader or by a song or by founding fathers or by the economy or by anything else. On the Harris Walls sign, they made this interesting political move of picking up the word freedom, which the Trump folks have basically dropped. And they start talking about it in a very conventional American way as freedom from the bad things. But interestingly, they've started to shift over to doing something that Trump and Vance can't do, which is talk about freedom to the good things, which I think actually is the right way of thinking about freedom.
So you talk about positive freedom and negative freedom, and that can be confusing at first blush, thinking, oh, negative freedom must be bad. No, just kind of explain what that means.
Yeah. I mean, negative freedom is kind of a trap or a dead end. As you say, it's not that it's wrong. It's just that it's a place you've got to get to before you get to other places. So negative freedom means freedom from. So negative freedom means no wall, no barbed wire, no oppression. And of course, that is very important. And there are times when you got to break down the wall and cut the barbed wire and end the oppression. At the same time, that's really only the beginning, because once there is no barrier, then you have the question of who you are and what do you care about, and what do you value and what do you love, and how are you going to find people to love and value together with. And that's positive freedom. Positive freedom is knowing who you are, what you actually care about, and being able to bring the things that you care about into real life. It's a problem for us Americans that we get stuck on negative freedom, because when you think that freedom is only freedom from, then you think, well, we got to make the government small because the government can only do bad things. And that's false. Sometimes the government does bad things, sometimes it does good things. But some of the things we need to be free in a positive sense, like schools, like you were just talking about, like parental leave, like vacation, like healthcare, like roads, a lot of the things that you need to be free as a person, you can only do if we work together. And the right kind of working together is a good government, which brings about freedom. So if you get stopped thinking that freedom is just negative, you never actually end up creating the land of the free, which is what we're supposed to be doing.
You spent a lot of time in Ukraine studying, talking to people, writing about Ukraine, understanding what's going on there. And they have a different kind of view about freedom and the war. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, thank you for that question. It was really refreshing for me and important to me to talk to Ukrainians in Ukraine about the book and about the ideas. It was one way that I was trying to keep myself honest. Because, of course, folks in Ukraine are not only talking about freedom, which they do a lot, they're taking risks and losing people because of their care about freedom. And so I wanted to be careful about the way they spoke about it. And there are a couple of interesting points, or three really. One is that it's all about the future, that freedom can't be about looping back to an imaginary past or a time when things used to be great. If we're going to be free, the time we're going to be free in is the time that's still to come. And if we can't imagine that time, we're probably not very free people. The second is what we were talking about, the positive bit. Ukrainians have an interesting word, which we don't really have, which is deoccupation. When a town or a village is is as we would say, liberated. They tend to say deoccupied. And there's an important point being made there, which is when you drive the bad thing out, no matter how bad it is, and Russian occupation is horrifying, it involves torture, it involves deportation of children, it involves the murder of local officials.
Well, it's genocide, really.
Yeah, I think so. But even ending that isn't enough for freedom, is the point, that you still have to clear the rubble, you still have to rebuild the houses, you got to get the bus lines going, you have to get the trains running. And then you can start to think about being free. And it's that, so that extreme situation, I think, reveals kind of a basic truth. And then the third thing has to do with the morals. So, I mean, freedom, I think, is the value of values, because freedom is the condition in which we can affirm and realize the things that we care about, the good things in life. And if that's right, if it's about values and not impulses, then over the course of time as a free person, you build up character. And then sometimes if you are a person of character, you can't just run away. You can't just follow impulses. You have to do the thing that you think you have to do. And that's what conversations with President Zelensky and other people brought home to me. So sometimes precisely because you're a free person, there's only really one thing that you can do.
So the opposite of free is not necessarily being enslaved. There is a state of being unfree.
That's an interesting question. I like it, because the thing about the word unfreedom, which I borrow from Czech dissidents and other people I admire, is that it reminds us that it's not everybody else's fault, that it's partly our fault. So it's not, if we're unfree, if we're not free, it might be because there's some kind of radical form of oppression, but it might also be because we're not taking responsibility. It might be because we don't love freedom enough. It might be that we're cooperating in some way with those who want to oppress us. It might be that we are obeying our future tyrants in advance. It might be that for the sake of comfort or conformity or whatever, we are conspiring in a future in which we're all less free. And so the word unfreedom helps us to take responsibility. It also helps us to remind, and going back to the positive negative thing, it reminds us that, you know, it's not just about the barriers, it's also about us taking responsibility for what we care about and for our own actions.
I think about, like, after in the United States, after the Civil War, and we freed people who were, or I say the word freed, we stopped them from being slaves. They were no longer being enslaved, but they weren't exactly free.
That's a beautiful example. And I like that I'm making you hesitate about using the word free. That's good. Because I think we have to treat that word free with a lot of care, more care than we do treat it with usually. But you make an excellent historical point. It's not enough to just remove some condition of oppression. You're going to need those 40 acres and a mule. You know, you're going to need a government which is not against you. You're going to need a government which allows you to vote.
You need access to the rule of law.
Exactly. The rule of law, which applies to everyone, and the rule of law applying to everyone is a matter not just of a rule in a book, but also of mutual respect among people, where a white person sees a black person as a person. And that's, you know, that hasn't been an easy thing for a lot of Americans over a lot of our history. And it's at the center of why we have trouble being free, I think, because when you don't recognize other people, you end up not understanding yourself and you fall into some bad myths and stories.
So we got to take a break here. This is a public radio station. We got to do a pledge drive. And thank you so much for standing by while we do that. And when we come back, I want to talk about Donald Trump and his, you know, what he's promising America. And it does seem to be that we will move into a nation that will be less free. There will have more unfreedom. And as the breaking down of the rule of law would be part of what would be happening here. We're going to talk about that when we come back from this break. We're going to be pitching for a pledge drive. And Tim Snyder, thank you for standing by. And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're continuing our conversation with Timothy Snyder. He is a historian. He's written multiple books. His latest book is On Freedom. And Tim, thank you so much for hanging with us through our pitch break there. I do want to ask you, get your reaction to this latest news about Donald Trump and Putin. Putin has confirmed that Donald Trump did provide him with COVID tests, but however, Putin is denying that they have been having phone calls with Donald Trump. after he left office. And what can you make sense of that for us?
I mean, we have to take a step back. I think, like, whatever turns out to be the truth there, and of course, it's very hard when you're dealing with two liars on such a global or even galactic scale like Putin and Trump. But the relationship between Trump and Putin is not something one can really doubt. Trump made a lot of money on Russian licensing deals where Russian entities gave him money to put his name on buildings which never turned out to be built. Russia worked really hard to get the man elected in 2016 and never made a secret of it. And we know about that, even though we might choose to forget it. In 2018 in Helsinki in Finland, Trump made a point of standing up in front of the world press and saying that he trusted Putin more than his own country's agencies, and so on and so forth, right? There's a basic affinity between the two men, which I think goes beyond the details of today's story and is worth keeping in mind when we think ahead to a Trump administration, because Americans don't really know enough of what Russia looks like now. And if we knew more about what Russia looks like now, I think we'd be on our guard.
But the idea that I'm trying to game out, like, why would Putin say, yes, I got the COVID test from Trump, and Trump said that was a lie, it didn't happen, but then Putin says, yeah, I did get those. And then he says, but I never had those phone calls with him. And I'm thinking, well, he's playing chess with truth. He's thinking, okay, I will give you this, but I will take away that. I will not, if you were believe me on this one, why wouldn't you believe me on the other?
I think we're probably mistaken to try to get drawn too deeply into this, because there are a couple of levels of mischief and manipulation going on. One is that Putin is constantly playing Trump. So of the two of them, one is smarter than the other. Trump is a talented politician. He is good at what he does, but Putin is much better. And there has never been a moment where Trump himself essentially describes Putin as the sort of politician that he would like to be like himself. So their communication that goes back between the two of them, I think one also has to understand in terms of Putin, like, keeping Trump on a line and going back and forth with the man. And the other thing which is going on is that we should all know that Putin wants Trump to win, just like the dictators of the world generally want Trump to win. But Putin is playing with us a little bit on this one, too. He's trying to cast doubt so folks who are voting for Trump might not realize, well, yes, I'm voting for the favorite of Putin and the dictators of the world.
You've said post-truth is pre-fascism, and we're definitely living in a post-truth world when we have J.D. Vance saying Springfield, Ohio Haitians are stealing and eating cats and dogs, when they're saying that FEMA is not providing relief to the people hurt by the hurricanes. And they say, well, it doesn't matter if they make it up. They don't care. It's as if you took the New York Times crossword puzzle and you just started filling in random letters and you say, I did it. I completed the puzzle. What a great guy I am. But it's just gibberish. I mean, nothing means anything when you live in a post-truth world.
Well, it's like completing the New York Times crossword puzzle with gibberish and then, you know, attacking with a baseball bat everybody who says that you didn't. I think it's a little bit more like that. You got to complete the analogy, because the post-truth leading to fascism is kind of evident with the Springfield, Ohio example that you gave, because the thing that J.D. Vance is doing is that he's saying, I don't have to tell the truth, as you say. That's part of it. I can make up stories. That's Vance's word. But they're not just any stories. They're stories about how the government can't do anything. And they're stories about how, instead of the government doing anything, Americans should fight it out among themselves. They're those kinds of stories. They're not just any story. Like, if we're being told that a group is eating our domestic animals, we're supposed to get angry, we're supposed to fight. That's their kind of politics. It's a big lie, but it's not any sort of big lie. It's a big lie which exonerates them from having ever to do anything, which they won't, to help the American people, but which is meant to get the American people energized to fight one another. So it's a shift from one kind of politics, a democratic or, if you prefer, Republican or constitutional form of politics, where we all have interests and votes and there are facts, into another kind of politics where leadership involves generating the stories which get us to fight one another. And that's fascism.
The United States economy, free enterprise, free market, it's based on freedom. If we moved into a world with less freedom, where cronyism, capitalism, market manipulation, I mean, is this going to, this would generally hurt most Americans? I mean, why aren't we talking about that?
I think that's a great point. I mean, and I wonder why people don't make that point more often. I mean, it's obvious that Trump cares not at all about the most vulnerable, but there's something about their program which is devastating for American business in general, and that's the destruction of the rule of law. If you look at the kinds of regimes they like, and the ones they say they like Viktor Orban's Hungary or Vladimir Putin's Russia, these are capitalist systems, but with favoritism, right? With cronyism, like you say, where a few people are going to stay rich and get richer, but everybody else is going to end up poorer. Hungary is a poor country compared to us. Russia is a very poor country compared to us, but we could get a lot poorer a lot faster if there's no rule of law. If we give up on the regulation on the banks, or we favor some over other, we can have their banking crisis. If we don't oversee the stock market and let a few cronies make money, the thing loses credibility and crashes. If businesses can't get stuff done because Project 2025 has fired all 40,000 of the competent people who do the approvals and the patents and all the rest, then people are going to lose their jobs. This seems to me that this is a middle of the road thing, which people should be talking about more, that if you do away with the rule of law, sure, Trump's buddies are going to be rich. That is your buddies being rich is a version of capitalism, but it's not the version of capitalism that Americans really should be wanting.
And the idea that you can lie without consequence, and that's something that Donald Trump has done throughout his career, but eventually some things don't care about your lies. A virus doesn't care about your lies, and it will continue to spread, and we have a pandemic, or even an economy may not care about your lies, and you will have markets collapse because the exchange of things are based on reality, not lies. So is that the comeuppance that we have to recognize? He can only, lying about whether or not your casino makes money makes no difference, but whether or not the country will be safe, secure, stable is something different.
I want to agree with you, but I want to start with a bigger point, which is that, or maybe just a more basic one, which is that in order to have a democracy, we all have to have access to facts. We have to believe in truth. We can't say, oh, I'm just going to sort of click on my favorite lie. We have to believe in truth, and we have to have institutions like local media, right? Like local radio, like local investigative reporting, which you just cited a moment ago. We have to have the institutions which keep us accustomed to having access to facts, because when we don't have that, then we lose our mooring. Everything feels slippery, and we start to latch on to the polarizing stuff and the conspiracy theories, and then you really can't have a democracy. So with Trump in particular, yes, there's a comeuppance, but the whole idea of characters like him is just to make sure that he and maybe a few people around him don't feel the comeuppance, and all the rest of us are going to feel that comeuppance. When the economy crashes, it's going to be okay for Trump. But it's not going to be okay for everybody else. But the ultimate form of comeuppance, and one of the bigger lies that we're going to have trouble with, is climate. We're at a moment where it really does matter whether we take climate change seriously. And Trump is somebody who has essentially said, I want the hydrocarbon oligarchs to pay me off so that we can have climate change. And the thing is, we're running out of time here, and there is a basic truth about what's happening. We don't lack the truth. We don't lack the tech. We could fix this thing. But if we lie about it and get somebody in office who's going to make it worse, then really we could. The hard truth is going to be faced by our children and grandchildren, who are facing a planet which is verging on being uninhabitable.
And an important part of that is having freedom of the press, which is something that Donald Trump has repeatedly attacked, and he would go after if he was elected president again and he had the power to do that. How important is freedom of the press for overall freedom?
Yeah. Again, I'm going to try to take a slightly bigger take on this, like I do in the book. freedom of the press is absolutely essential, and it, but it's essential for the the little guy. It's essential for the smaller entities. It's essential for the people who are actually going out and taking risks to find out the truth. And so freedom of the press corresponds with creating the conditions where journalists can make a decent living. Freedom of the press is not just the negative freedom, right? It's not just the ability to start a newspaper. It's also thinking in terms of regulations, incentives, and so forth, structures provided by government, bandwidth provided by government, so that the fact finders can have a bigger place in our country. So of course you're right. Trump is going to take the people. He says he's going to round up the people who say things he doesn't like. But thinking about how he would make this a more free country, or how he can make it a country which was better at producing free people, we should be thinking in terms of what government can do to expand freedom of the press, or expand the press, make it easier for the press to function.
Okay, take a 1 minute break. We'll be right back. We'll be continuing our conversation with Timothy Snyder, talking about his new book on freedom. He's also written a lot about tyranny, and we want to hear. If you got a question, give us a call, 833-877-8255. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Timothy Snyder's here with us talking about freedom. His new book is on freedom. And so, Tim, when we talk about freedom too, positive freedom. Is that woke?
I mean, I think the opposite of woke is being undead. You know, I don't really understand what's so bad about being woke. Like, if you're not woke, you're undead, you're a zombie. I think of the two of them, one is better than the other. I hadn't thought about the question this way. I guess I would say that positive freedom has to do with happiness and joy and authenticity and self-fulfillment. And one of the things which I see which is wrong in our country is that when folks talk about being free or freedom, they're often angry. And that's a bad sign, because it's a sign that they're thinking about freedom just in terms of what they're against, or ever more often, whom they're against. Whereas freedom is fundamentally about what you're for, what you like, what you can admit that you actually care about in taking the next step, being able to cooperate with other people about those things you care about. That's what freedom is. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm happy to talk about what woke means, I'm happy to talk about campus woke, whatever, but I would kind of want to get beneath our immediate reactions and our immediate right. discourse and say, like, we all think freedom is the thing. What is it?
Yeah. So I was trying to get to that woke is a positive thing. If you want to express your sexuality, your gender, if you want to, I mean, there's who you can marry, who you want to marry. You know, that's, you should have that freedom. And that seems to be up for grabs right now in this election.
Yeah, I think that's a deep point, because like who you love, or how you love, or who you want to love. Those are exactly the kinds of things that are sometimes difficult to talk about. And they're the kinds of things where you kind of need other people to be involved. And freedom has to do with exactly those things. Those things, not only those things, it also has to do with, with what kind of bike you want to ride, or whether you like to repair cars. It has to do with all those personal things which make us the beautiful, eccentric, unpredictable creatures that we are. And it's a land of the free when people are comfortable or feel safe in owning up to being who they are, and are able to find other people with who also like the same things. That's what everyday freedom is about. And interestingly, you know, I write about, like, we're talking about contemporary American stuff. I write about communism. I write about Nazism, and like the anti-communist dissidents, the people who went to prison, who went to the gulag, when they talked about freedom, they talked about this everyday stuff, being who you were, being able to live a normal life according to your idea of what's normal. That's the thing. And it sounds simple, but it's actually hard to get at. And when we think of the government as the enemy, or other people as the enemy, or we just follow our impulses, then we can't get to it.
You were quoted in May 2017 that it's pretty inevitable that Trump would stage a coup and overthrow democracy, that he would be like Hitler and do a Reichstag fire. Do you think you got that prediction right?
Well, it's sweet of you to mention that, because generally when you predict something correctly, people then people mock you at the time, and then they don't recognize later on when you got it right. Yeah, I got it right. I mean, he did attempt a coup on the basis of a fake emergency, which was the supposed election fraud, right? I mean, and he covered it up with a Hitlerian scale big lie, namely that he won the election in a historic landslide. So I got it right, but I'm not important. What's important is that that's a form of politics. Attempting coups is a form of politics. And the thing we know about people who will try one coup is that they will try another coup. And we're in a funny sort of country where, you know, in a rule of law state, if you try a coup, you would be convicted for it because you'd be committing crimes, which the man obviously did convict. Or if you're not in a rule of law state, your political enemies would, you know, when you lose, they would do away with you. But we're in this kind of weird middle zone. We're not quite a rule of law state. And happily, we're not yet that kind of authoritarian regime. And so we're just kind of stumbling forward with a guy who is a coup plotter and will have every reason to do this kind of thing again when the circumstances seem to him to be appropriate.
So, I mean, there was the January 6th, and the people who were charging up the Capitol, they thought they were doing that in the name of freedom. The MAGA shaman, you know, he was on the floor of the House, and he was screaming freedom in his bizarre way. I mean, it does seem like there is an attempt to muddle what is freedom, and then weaponize that.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is one way that I am a conservative. I think there's a right and wrong, and I think there's a right and wrong definition of freedom. And I don't think we have to say that everybody who uses the word is actually talking about the thing. And it isn't even always just a matter of muddling it. It can just be a matter of being 180 degrees completely incorrect. If you're acting to hurt other people on the basis of things that are entirely false, which are generated exclusively for the personal interest of a would-be tyrant, you are not acting in the name of freedom. There's nothing free about what you're doing. If you're living inside somebody else's story, you're not free. If you're living inside of somebody else's lie, you're not free. If you're bringing down the freedoms of your fellow Americans, you're not acting for freedom. So sometimes people are just wrong.
Well, you did predict that America will not survive another Trump campaign. Have we survived Trump's latest campaign?
I think what I said was a little bit more nuanced than that. But I will happily say that the risks of a Trump victory are systemic. That is to say, they have to do with the kind of country that we end up having. Yeah. I think the rule of law, which we talked about earlier, when it's violated, that can spin off into various scenarios, yeah. Like law enforcement agencies not necessarily one to enforce the things Trump says, some states rebelling. It can lead off into regime threatening type scenarios.
Timothy Snyder, historian, he's been called the leading interpreter of our dark times. His latest book is On Freedom. Thank you so much, Tim, for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, David. Thank you.
And that's The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be taking a break and doing some pitching to keep Texas Public Radio strong. Stay with us.